This time on Weather Brains.
We don't know a lot about thunderstorms.
But scientists are taking another step to find out. They're heading to Costa Rica, and we'll tag along too. Plus, we dig into some noise you heard on a previous Weather Brains. And watch out, the results may bug you.
Katydid. Cicada.
On Weather Brains 101 with Professor Peters, we learn about radio signs and the valuable service they perform. And can you believe what some people will do when it comes to global warming?
This is absolutely completely insane to try to get hundreds of naked people or thousands of naked people together.
We'll explain. And on This Week in Weather History, Bill Murray looks at the history-making weather flight Colonel James Duckworth made back in 1943. And J.B. Elliott takes us to one of the wettest places on the planet.
In one 12-month period, they received over 1,000 inches of rain.
If you don't know where it is, we'll tell you. It's all coming up. It's episode number 78 of Weather Brains, the netcast that's all about weather, produced by The Weather Company. Hello, I'm David Black. With me for this ride, Brian Peters, J.B. Elliott, Kevin Selly, and the illustrious James Spann. Mr. Spann, how you doing?
I need to get out my pocket dictionary and see what illustrious means. I don't know if that's good or bad.
I don't know what it is either. I just thought I'd use it.
Sounds good, though. Very impressive word.
Speaking of illustrious, Brian Peters is always colorful for one reason or another. Why are you colorful, a person of note, this time? What trouble have you gotten into?
I didn't get into any trouble at all. I drove the interns and Mr. Spann all the way down to Jim's Pit Barbecue in Billingsley, Alabama. So I'm not in any trouble at all.
But you probably
maybe eat 5 loads of banana pudding.
So, J.B. Elliott, are you full of barbecue and pudding as well?
It's mostly banana pudding. The barbecue is all entwined, and it's driving me crazy.
Well, Kevin Selly, you must feel left out. You're in Dallas, Texas. Kind of hard for you to make the trip over for the barbecue.
I have fond memories of going to various barbecue places with James Spann back in my day. And yes, I'm very jealous, and I miss that type of activity, David.
Well, that's just a price you have to pay in the Lone Star State. And I tell you what, they've had their share of weather going on out there. Where's all the major weather occurring right now that folks are really having to deal with? I can think of one place. What about you guys? Who's really getting pounded right now?
Southwest Texas has just been, over the weekend, too much rain, and it will continue here for the next couple of days, just under a bullseye, and they really didn't have much of a chance to dry out from the epic flooding from a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, I am from that part of the country originally, and in my hometown, people, and this is nothing humorous in any shape or form, but it's a regular thing. People get washed away. They drive through low water crossings, and flash floods come along and sweep them away, and that stuff still goes on, and it's very unfortunate.
Hey, Kevin, I heard a major news guy on a major news network over the weekend refer to Bexar County as Bexar County, but it's pronounced Bear, isn't it?
Yes, exactly right.
That's where I grew up.
He ain't from around here.
Yeah, that's right. That's where San Antonio is, and it is a funny spelling, but it is indeed pronounced Bear County, JB.
That's what I thought.
And there are other parts of the country where they'll come after you. For example, in one part of Alabama, if you pronounce G-U-I-N as Gwyn, James, what'll happen to you if you say that pronunciation?
They'll take you out of the woodshed.
Yeah, they'll come after you. That's not how it's pronounced.
And don't call it Gwyn either.
No.
I heard some news people call it Gwyn.
Yeah,
you know what? That's actually, you know, the site of one of the most violent tornadoes in this country's history during the super outbreak. So you'd think most weather people would know how to say the name. It's Gwyn.
Right. Anyway, well, we'll keep the names correct, and hopefully the weather will be cooperative for a while. Some people are really getting soaked, like we talked about in Texas, and other parts of the country still kind of looking for more rain. But in the eastern and southeast part of the country, they're picking up a little bit. Showers and a few thunderstorms here and there, so the maybe the drought's easing a tiny bit, but not really officially for many areas. Speaking of showers and storms, they're often noisy, complete with lightning and torrential rain. Sometimes they're accompanied by hail. Thunderstorms happen just about all over the planet. And for all that we've learned about them, there's still a tremendous amount we don't know about these thunderstorm characters, too. Members of a NASA-sponsored storm science project, though, are spending the summer in Costa Rica. They're trying to learn more about how thunderstorms behave and whether they play a role in climate change. The team members are doing this by getting as close to the storms as possible and in a number of different ways. Kevin Selly caught up with the lead mission scientist in Costa Rica and takes us inside the project known as TC4.
Last time on WeatherBrains 101, Professor Peters told us about the troposphere, the lowest 60,000 feet or so in the atmosphere where most of the weather happens. Notice I said most of the weather.
Yeah, there are a lot of questions. We don't know how rapidly the process happens. We're not really sure how much wet materials actually go through into the stratosphere. And the stratosphere is where all the ozone is, and if certain chemicals are going up through this region that get transported from the low, from near the surface up to these high altitudes quickly in tropical weather systems, we're not sure how much of that really gets through. So we're trying to really understand what this buffer zone between the weather sphere and the stratosphere is like, and how quickly air is going to commit into the stratosphere.
That is Dr. David Starr, and he is the lead mission scientist for a program called Tropical Composition Cloud and Climate Coupling. Thankfully, they call it TC4 for short, and so will we. The basic idea of TC4 is to find out how air in the troposphere, where the weather happens, gets into the next layer up, the stratosphere, and what effect it has when it gets there, which happens not necessarily a lot, but maybe enough to make a difference. And one of the ways seems to be from thunderstorms.
We have some fairly well-formulated theories. I mean, some of them are competing. Some people believe that it's a slow ascent process where air just very slowly rises up through the tropopause at, you know, a centimeter, a millimeter a second sort of velocities. Other people think that deep convective clouds directly inject air into the stratosphere. The reality is probably somewhere in between.
And the pursuit of the somewhere in between has led Dr. Starr and a team of about 300 researchers to Costa Rica to fly around the tops of thunderstorms.
It flies at 65,000 feet, 20 kilometers, and it has a satellite simulator package on it. So right now NASA is observing the world with quite a number of very sophisticated and in many cases fairly new satellites. But with this airplane, we can put the basic, almost similar sensor package right on a plane that flies at high altitude, and we can put it where we want and have it be there for a while. As you know, a lot of the satellites go whizzing by at 7 kilometers a second, so you get kind of one snapshot, and then you wait 12 hours, and you get another snapshot. In this case, we can look kind of continuously, and then we have two other aircraft which are taking some remote sensing measurements, but one of the primary functions is to take what we call in situ measurements. That is, they are trying to go up and see what, in fact, was in the air that we looked at with our satellites or our satellite simulator aircraft. So they're trying to collect cloud particles, gas samples of various types of gases, particularly chosen so that we can try and trace the processes and know how that air got there and how its properties were, in fact, determined.
The team is using weather radars and balloons, several NASA satellites, and 3 aircraft for their research. Flying around the tops of thunderstorms is not always the smoothest ride.
No, it can be bumpy, but we've got a good, really good pilots, and they take care of the scientists, and so it can be rocking back and forth, but we have complete confidence with our NASA pilots.
That is Michael Goodman, an atmospheric scientist from NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville. He brought along some new software that is allowing scientists to see all of the data that is being collected at the same time, even back in the States.
We're utilizing a software package that we developed at Marshall Space Flight Center called the Real-Time Mission Monitor. And with that, we're able to bring in real time numerous data sets, airborne data sets, that is, those from the DC-8 and the ER-2 and the WV-57, those are the 3 satellites that are flying. But in addition to those aircraft, we're bringing in satellite data and surface data, such as we have some research radar located here in Costa Rica, and also lightning networks. So all this is integrated into one visualization package, which we call the Real-Time Mission Monitor. And you can view it out over the web, at least the scientists can. And so whether you're in Costa Rica, here we are in San Jose, or if you're located in the States, or really any place where the scientists may be located, you can simultaneously view what's going on. So everyone has the same picture at the same time, unlike previous experiments in which sometimes you're, certainly if you're not located there, you're flying in the dark. And even then, we're able to track the satellites, and the aircraft and the satellites. So you're able to really get a feel for what's going on in real time.
The next few weeks are dedicated to gathering the data with some analysis in between, but the scientists know there is a long period of study ahead as opposed to making any conclusions too soon.
No, it's too early. Research is not something that you turn around and can get results instantaneously. We live in an instantaneous McDonald's-type world, McNews world, but it really does take time to calibrate the instruments and the science and do the correct science.
How long will you hope to be there?
We'll be there through about August 9th or so. It started on July 14th with the first science flight on July 17th. So it's about 3 weeks, about 300 scientists will be here on and off as people cycle in and out. When we're not flying, we're putting long days, 12, 14-hour days are not unusual. Due to the fact that there's could be thunderstorms in and around the landing area during the mid-afternoon, we tend to take off early in the morning to avoid thunderstorms at landing, because you don't want to land in and around a thunderstorm near the airport. So our flights typically take off at, let's say, 6 a.m., and arrive back around anywhere from noon to 2 o'clock. And so consequently, we're up at 4 a.m., 3 a.m. Earlier, prepping the aircraft and getting ready for each flight. And we're flying every other day, so when we're not flying, we're pouring over the data. So long days, 7 days a week, nonstop for the next 3 weeks.
And we will be looking for their reports. David?
You know, another real boost for TC4, guys, thanks to technology, is made possible by instant messaging. They made a quick reference to real-time sharing of the data, but I think this is an amazing development in meteorological research. Scientists in aircraft, on the ground, anywhere they may be, are able now to communicate with each other in real time to discuss what they're seeing, and that's a huge change from years past when they had to gather all this data and then compare it among each other days and weeks or even months later. So I would imagine that's probably going to open up new frontiers in research and understanding and spark some real creativity.
Yeah, David, I think when this research is done, or when the data gathering is done, and that's only a couple of weeks, but for a long, long time afterwards, a lot of really interesting stuff is going to come out of this. I apologize for the noisy phone quality, by the way, but we were talking to them from Costa Rica, so they were busy, and that's a long way away, and so I appreciate them taking the time. But it took me a while to grasp exactly what they were looking for, because in one of the press releases I saw about this, it said, oh, thunderstorms and global warming, and then you go, oh, my gosh, where is this going? But what they're really trying to find out is, you know, whatever is in the troposphere, the lowest layer of the atmosphere, in some way, shape, or form, it seems as though some of that is being pushed up through the tropopause and into the stratosphere. And so then you say, okay, well, how much is going? How fast is it going? How does it get there? And those are the kinds of things that they're trying to find out. But when you start talking about what's in the stratosphere, then you get into this global warming issue. Okay, well, are we putting stuff in the atmosphere on the lower levels that are going to go up into the higher levels and have an impact? And I think it's going to be a long time before they get any answers, but it's the very exciting start to a pretty neat process, David.
And the bottom line is, there is a whole lot that we still, to this day, do not yet understand about thunderstorms and how they behave and form.
Hey, Kevin, any ideas to why they chose Costa Rica?
They said one of the things, specifically that location exactly, I don't know, I imagine it had something to do with the availability of the airport and things like that, but what they were trying to do, they felt like they had some level of understanding in the mid-latitudes across the United States and better access to data and research opportunities with thunderstorms and punching the tropopause in the mid-levels, and so what they wanted to do was get closer to the intertropical convergence zone or even a little closer to the equator, but where those thunderstorms were happening. And get some data at that latitude level, Brian.
Gotcha.
You know, we've heard James Spann mention several times in the past about the absolute impossibility of predicting where a thunderstorm is going to pop up and what area it's going to rain over on at any given point during a summer weather pattern. Who knows? Maybe these folks in TC4 might be laying the groundwork to find out more about storm behavior that one day, probably not soon, but maybe James will one day get his wish and be able to pinpoint predict where a thunderstorm would fall or occur.
Yep. Now, I've said it before. A sign of real maturity in this business is understanding how much we don't know. And we don't know a lot about thunderstorms and tornadoes, so I'm all for it. And I'd like to hear you say Costa Rica one more time, David.
Bueno, Costa Rica.
Nice.
Does that
nice.
Work?
Nice.
All right.
Like that.
Well, all right, let's move on. Last time, if you were listening to the previous episode of Weather Brains, number 77, we heard about the cicada. Boy, did we ever hear the cicada. You see, Brian Peters was joining us from an Alabama state park where the cicadas were singing their songs in full force in the background. But is it possible the good professor was giving us a story that has, well, some bugs in it? All right, Kevin, you've been looking into this. What have you come up with?
Actually, David, it wasn't me. We got laughing about it, as you know, last time. We thought it was so funny, all that chirping going on in the background. And I went home and I told my wife and my son, who's six, about all the noise going on. And they are, of course, regular Weather Brains listeners. And when they listened, after they listened to the program, they came back to me and said, wait a second, you guys don't know what you're talking about. Because I had said crickets and I didn't know. But anyway, some big research was done and this is what they found out.
Weather Brains 102 with Associate Professor Selly.
Last time on Weather Brains, Mr. Peters entertained us all with the sound of chirping from Mount Tihah, while my mom and I enjoyed listening to the show and never miss Weather Brains 101. We are sure that the noise was not cicadas, but in fact the sound of katydids. That was the sound of the bugs from episode 77 from Mount Tihah. This is the sound of a katydid. And this is the sound of a cicada. A cicada makes a loud buzzing sound on sunny summer days. The katydid begins making a chirping sound late in the afternoon and continues until late at night. Katydid. Cicada. Katydid. Cicada. This is Matthew Shaw reporting for Weather Brains, and I never steal Wi-Fi.
Hey, that was his line of the year.
Here you go, gents. There are graphic groups that know more about bugs than six-year-old boys, so I'm going with them.
That's classic.
That's the funniest thing since we started Weather Brains.
I had one.
That's the first guy that's actually had sense on this show.
Yeah.
You know, we may have to bring him back from time to time and just kind of knock some sense into all the weather geeks here at Weather Brains.
Oh, I'd love to hear it.
Matthew is an all-star.
All right. Good. 2 points for Matthew. Let's move on.
There you go, Matthew.
Yeah, let's move on to the weather roundtable where we just talk about weather items on anybody's mind any given moment. Mr. Peters, since you have obviously been discredited now and there's scandal amongst us about what we were really hearing at the park that time. What do you want to talk about?
I'm going to have to be looking for katydids, I guess.
That's right.
I have to plead some sense of, I don't know, insanity here. I'd always been told that those were cicadas. I never looked into it. So I appreciate getting the record set straight.
I thought you were right, too. I said crickets, so shows what I know.
Brian has learned one of the first things I learned in the television weather business. Tell them what you know, and don't tell them what you don't know.
But see, I thought I knew.
Trouble every time.
What's on my mind is global warming.
Uh-oh.
Now, don't turn off the program right there.
Reef.
I think it's absolutely amazing the lengths to which humans will go for different topics.
Okay, like what lengths will they go to, Brian?
And it turns out that this ad is appearing, and I read, volunteers wanted, volunteers willing to take off their clothes and have their picture taken
on a freezing cold alpine glacier.
Funny Brian would come up with this, don't you guys think?
Yes, I know. It turns out that New York artist Spencer, and I think I'm pronouncing his name right, Spencer Tunick.
Oh, that guy.
Yes. Is trying to bring attention to global warming by shooting literally thousands of people on a glacier, a Swiss glacier, which is predicted to disappear by 2080. And they're looking for volunteers. And I think this is absolutely... completely insane that we would use this topic to try to get hundreds of naked people or thousands of naked people together. But I did enjoy Greenpeace's take on it. They want people who are going to assemble for this to use public transportation to get there.
Oh, man.
Okay. I got it off my chest now. Thank you.
Are you heading over there, Brian?
No.
He'll be out there selling hot dogs.
I'm not going to touch that one.
You guys remember this guy? He was the one that caused the big ruckus. Was it? It's been a couple of years now. Ian, I think it was Cincinnati, because he did one of these, you know, tens of thousands of naked people shots. But one of the reporters from the local television station decided to disrobe, and it was a woman, and a fairly well endowed woman, and she participated in the photo shoot. But it caused a big dust up amongst journalists, because I think the shoot where the photo shoot was sometime in, like, I don't know, June or July, and the station held the story until November sweeps period and did big, massive promotion. And so there was a big dust up about that, but that was that same photographer.
I thought there might be some questions about too much reporter involvement or getting too close to the story. You know, getting down to the bare facts is one thing.
I think it's also interesting that this shoot will take place at, are you ready for this? An undisclosed location. So how can you make plans to go to it? I don't know.
Well, for Brian's sake, I hope it's not Mount Cheetah.
Me too.
When you've got that many people naked, it's not going to be an undisclosed location for very long, I wouldn't think. Brian,
speaking of reporters, I know I'm breaking format here. Did you guys see Miles O'Brien on CNN? He was having this interaction with J.C. Watts, who is a former congressman from Oklahoma. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, isn't this guy a journalist, Miles O'Brien?
Yes.
That would be my understanding.
He's in this debate with Watts. He said that the global warming debate is over. We're done. It's finished. And I thought journalists were to present both sides of the story. And all of a sudden, he's an advocate for this. What's up with that?
Well, it's a different era.
All right. Well, I'm chasing a bad rabbit. But maybe Miles O'Brien will come on the show with us.
Quite a few of the folks, it seems like, at CNN are becoming very cited in their comments, I've noticed.
Let's get Matthew to interview Miles O'Brien.
Really? He could be our investigative reporter.
Well, yeah. You know, there was an era when reporting meant that you didn't throw any opinion into the mix, one way or the other. But you just don't see that as much anymore.
Nope.
Same with, you know, global warming and politics and everything else out there. On to Mr. J.B. Elliott. What have you got for the Weather Roundtable, sir?
Let's take an imaginary trip to Cherrapunji, India.
Is there going to be global warming over there, too, or not?
No.
Okay, I'm ready. Let's go.
And why in the world are we going there? And by the way, this is going to be dull as compared to Matthew's revelation.
Well, but we're going to be anyway, keeping our clothes on, though, for this, right? So that's a good
thing. Yeah. We're going there because it's another very interesting weather spot on Earth. And you know me, I'm interested in extremes. In fact, most people think of it as the wettest spot on Earth. There has been some debate over the years whether Cherrapunji is really the wettest spot or a place on the high elevation on the windward side in Hawaii. But Cherrapunji gets an average of 450 inches of rain per year. That average is based on about 75 years of record. But in one 12-month period, they received over 1,000 inches of rain. But here's the unusual part. They get their rain from the monsoons, so almost all of their annual rain comes in only 4 months. The city has a population of about 10,000 and located at an elevation about 4,200 feet. The extremely moist monsoon winds from the Bay of Bengal spreading northward, of course, has to rise as they get closer to the Himalayas. This melts out all of the moisture, and it can rain almost continuously for a month or two at a time. After 4 months of almost continuous rain. The wind shifts around to the north, and the rest of the year there is almost no rain. In fact, it gets so dry that people have to travel for many miles to find fresh water. The town's water system can't handle the 4 months of downpours. So let's compare their average of 450 inches of rain with some familiar cities, just to give you a perspective. 37 inches in Seattle, 39 inches in St. Louis, 45 inches in Tampa, 35 inches in Des Moines, 39 inches in the nation's capital, 13 inches in Los Angeles, and 9.47 inches in Albuquerque. That's wow. The end of my story.
Wow, we are talking a deluge. So there is no way to control this and have it spread out in more even increments. Just no way at all to do that, is there?
No way in the world.
Man, they get pounded, don't they?
Sure do.
Thank you, sir. I don't know if you guys heard about this. This is a tragic story in the news, but kind of bizarre. We talk about lightning safety a lot. A 36-year-old man was killed when he was struck by lightning July 22nd. This happened when he surfaced while diving off of Florida's Atlantic coast. Stephen Wilson was diving with three other people. This happened near Deerfield Beach, about 40 miles north of Miami. Investigators say Wilson had surfaced about 30 feet from the boat when a lightning bolt struck his tank. The other divers with him struggled to get Wilson back into the boat and radioed for help. He was rushed to a beach nearby where a crew gave him CPR, but he was pronounced dead at North Broward Medical Center in Pompano Beach. A severe thunderstorm warning had been in effect for Broward County. The medical examiner's office there planned an autopsy to determine if he died from electrocution or drowning. You just never know about thunderstorms. You just got to be safe all the time in the strangest of places, don't you?
JB, what do you say about lightning?
Lightning is frightening, and I saw a story this week in the paper where lightning struck a guy that was listening to his iPod, struck his headphones.
I tell you what, anytime, any place, and I think
Bill won't listen to Weather Brains.
Yeah, I hope not too. Bill Murray talks about a lightning strike too coming up in the Weather Center with This Week in Weather History. Email to the Weather Brains email inbox this week. We heard from Jake Taft in Birmingham, Alabama. Thanks for contacting us, Jake. Time now for the Weather Center. Starting off with the distinguished Professor Peters. I don't know though about his credibility now after this cicada deal, but anyway, he's going to teach us about what was that?
It's shot.
Yeah, it's. Shot down the tubes. We might as well not even do this. Nobody's going to ever believe him again. Well, I tell you what. Let's give him a chance, guys. Let's see if he can possibly redeem himself with this edition of Weather Brains 101. What do you guys think? Fair enough?
We'll give him a chance.
All right. One more shot for the distinguished professor. He's going to teach us this time about the radio sonde and its valuable contributions. And on This Week in Weather History, Bill Murray recounts this week in 1943 when Colonel James Duckworth took a first-ever trip of its kind, a deliberate flight straight into a hurricane.
Weather Brains 101 with Professor Peters.
The troposphere is where the weather occurs. So how do we get reliable measurements of those conditions? For over 60 years, observations of the upper atmosphere have been made by using radiosondes. The radiosonde is a small, expendable instrument package suspended below a 6-foot-high balloon filled with hydrogen or helium. As the radiosonde is carried aloft, sensors measure profiles of pressure, temperature, and relative humidity. These sensors are linked to a battery-powered 300-milliwatt radio transmitter that sends the sensor measurements to a ground receiver on a radio frequency around 1700 megahertz. By tracking the position of the radiosonde in flight, wind speed and wind direction information are also obtained. A radiosonde flight can last up to 2 hours. During this time, the radiosonde can ascend to over 110,000 feet and travel more than 125 miles from the release point. When the balloon expands beyond its elastic limit, you know what happens. It bursts. A small parachute then allows the instrument to fall gently back to Earth without endangering anyone. Only about 20% of the approximately 75,000 radiosondes released by the National Weather Service each year are found and returned for reconditioning. These rebuilt radiosondes are used again, saving the cost of a new instrument. A complete radiosonde package costs about $350. Although all the data from the flight are used, data from the surface to 400 millibar pressure level, or about 23,000 feet, are considered minimally acceptable for National Weather Service operations. Should a flight fail before reaching 400 millibars, a second release is often made. Worldwide, there are nearly 900 upper air observation stations. Most are located in the Northern Hemisphere, and all observations are taken usually at the same time each day, 00 and 12Z UTC, 365 days a year. Observations are made by the National Weather Service at about 92 stations in the continental United States, with data exchanged between countries through international agreements. The data is applied to a broad spectrum of efforts, including input for computer-based weather prediction models, local severe storm, aviation and marine forecasts, weather and climate change research, input for air pollution models, and ground truth for satellite data. The Radiosonde, the balloon gets all the credit, but the Radiosonde does all the work. That's WeatherBrains 101 for this edition. If you have questions about weather terms, send them to question@weatherbrains.com.
Let's take a look back at some interesting weather history for the week of July 24th through the 30th. Now, back in 1943, tracking hurricanes was a difficult business. There were very few ships at sea because of the threat of German U-boats, and those that were out at sea generally maintained radio silence. The British suffered mightily from the lack of weather reports over the Atlantic, being forced to use precious aircraft to fly weather observation missions. Back in Bryan, Texas, Colonel James P. Duckworth was in charge of the instrument flying school. Back in the 1930s, there hadn't been any such thing as instrument flying. Everything was visual. But Duckworth, a pilot for Eastern Air Transport, the precursor for Eastern Airlines, re-signed to go back into active duty with the Army Air Corps because, as he said, the war wasn't going to stop because of weather. On the morning of July 27, 1943, he made his way to the base to have breakfast. As he ate, he learned there was a hurricane making landfall near Galveston. Hard to believe because the weather in Bryan that morning was beautiful, just 100 miles away from the coast. The storm was expected to pass near Houston during the afternoon. Now, Duckworth saw it as the perfect opportunity to do what no one had intentionally done up until that time, which was fly into a hurricane. Now, he suggested to one of his breakfast companions, Lieutenant Ralph O'Hare, that they take a single-engine AT-6 trainer and fly into the storm for fun. Now, there were some new B-25s at the base, but it would be hard justifying using one of them for this unsanctioned mission. And even as 100-mile-per-hour winds were raking the coast, Duckworth and O'Hare took off for Galveston. They called the tower at Houston and said they were flying to the Galveston area, where the incredulous operator asked them if they knew there was a hurricane. They said yes, and the controller said, "Give me an update on where you are so we'll be able to direct crews to your wreckage." As they flew toward the hurricane, they were in the weaker western semicircle of the storm. Nearing the eye wall, they experienced the violent up-and-down turbulence that they said made them feel like a bone in a dog's mouth. Suddenly, they broke into the clear air of the eye, flew around for a few minutes, and headed back to the base, where they were met by the staff meteorological officer. The weatherman wanted to know why they had not included him in their historic flight. They responded by telling him, "Hop in, we'll go back again." The meteorologist kept a very detailed diary of observations. Duckworth did not immediately realize the significance of his feat. Later that year, one of his superiors summoned him to tell the pilot that he had been recommended for the Distinguished Flying Cross. The unassuming Duckworth did receive the medal for flying into the hurricane for the first time, twice in the same day. Realizing the benefit of more specific information on hurricanes, regular reconnaissance flights were started the very next year, and Weather Bureau meteorologists used the information about the 1944 Great Atlantic Hurricane to issue better warnings and save lives. Now, it's back on July 29, 2005 that a Boy Scout hike up Mount Whitney in California turned tragic when lightning struck the tarp that had been set up in a meadow to shelter the scouts from rain. The scout leader and one Boy Scout were killed. The scouts from Troop 7001 in St. Helena, California, had been on a 9-day hike along the John Muir Trail. Scouts were able to keep one troop member alive by administering CPR for over an hour. That's this week in weather history.
Thank you very much, Bill Murray. If you'd like to contact the Weather Geeks at Weather Brains, our email address is question@weatherbrains.com. And we have a toll-free telephone number you may use as well for leaving voicemails. The number is 1-888-247-8627. That's 1-888-247-8627. For the Weather Brains crew, James Spann, Kevin Selly, J.B. Elliott, and Brian Peters, I'm David Black. Thank you for listening, and we hope you can join us again next time. Weather Brains is copyright 2007, all rights reserved. Adios. Enjoy that show, guys. I still think that Peters is planning a trip for that photo shoot. What do you guys think?
Yes.
David, I think the Weather Service is waiting for your check. You told me if I did a story on Radiosondes,
right,
you'd pay the bill for a year. The Weather Service said $27 million would just about cover it.
No speak English. New to country. No speak English.
David's from Costa Rica.
Si, senor, Costa Rica.
And, you know, I can't help but think, well, Bill's piece about the Duckworth, I can't help but think, you realize that was less than 70 years ago?
It's amazing.
Isn't that amazing?
It is.
Interesting.
The pace of technology is dizzying.
I got three quick before we go. The TC4 website will be linked on our website, weatherbrains.com. Bill, who couldn't join us at the last minute, wanted to mention a new product at the NHC's website. We've linked that as well. It's an experimental graphical tropical weather outlook product.
I took a quick look at that thing. That's pretty cool.
It's kind of neat. It, rather than just text, so that's worth looking at.
Yeah, I think people are going to like that.
The third and final thing would be the announcement of my son's new program called Weather Bugs.
That's it.
Weather Bugs.
How old is Matthew now?
6.
Wow.
We want him back soon.
So he has more sense than this whole group combined.
6 going on 21.
I resemble that remark.
Yeah.
It's not going to be too long before he asks you for the keys to go out on a date, Kev.
Ooh, man. Not sure if I like that idea.
All right.
All right, guys.
Enjoy it, gang.
Okay.
See y'all.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Anna Pudding.
Wish I had some.
Me too. It was good.
Yes.